Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. When he started writing his book about Mount Washington, author Dan Sesney thought it would be about the mountain's famous weather, its geology, the natural wonders, its history. But those topics, he says, took a backseat to the people who've made Mount Washington what it is, a mythological place, beloved and feared, inspiring feats of imagination, athleticism, and playfulness. Today in The Exchange, journalist and author Dan Sesney on his new book, The White Mountain, Rediscovering Mount Washington's Hidden Culture. Let's hear from you. Send us your questions, your stories, and your pictures of Mount Washington. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Dan Sesney joins me in studio. And Dan, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you write that over the course of 2017, Mount Washington became my obsession. How so?
Yes. Well, I took one calendar year out, January 1st, 2017 to December 31st, 2017. And the original conceit behind the book, as I sat in my publisher's kitchen over tea talking about the book, was a year in the life of Mount Washington, right? If you go, I mean, what we've been writing about, Europeans have been writing about Mount Washington for 400 years. There's a lot of literature out there. So, but that literature is all very specific. Books on the weather, books on the geology, books on hikers. What I wanted to do was look at, take a snapshot, a 365-day snapshot of that piece of landscape that casts such a long shadow on us, on what I thought was on New Hampshire. But as it turns out, that shadow goes a lot further. You know, that shadow covers the country and the world. That's how significant Mount Washington has been. So when I talk about an obsession, what I'm talking about is I wanted to immerse myself in the mythology and in the culture and in the history of the mountain. And what ended up being was that I was immersing myself in the people of Mount Washington.
And all sorts of people.
All
I mean, artists, athletes,
yeah.
Scientists, inventors. I mean,
yeah.
Just give us a sense of the wide array of sometimes a little bit goofy people,
yeah.
But also very serious people who have been drawn to this mountain.
Right. It was like pulling on. It was like pulling on a little thread. You know, once you ask one person, you know, tell me your story, like we're going to do today. Tell me your story about Mount Washington. Everyone has a story about Mount Washington. It got to the point where after a few weeks of doing this, I would simply have a notebook and I would say to someone that I would meet at a museum or at a art show or at the top of the mountain, I would say, tell me your story about Mount Washington. I'd have to sit back for 10 or 15 minutes and listen to their story about Mount Washington. I remember back when I first came to New Hampshire, this is 20 years, going on 20 years now. And I was doing a story on a climber, a guy by the name of Jim Gagne, who ended up being sort of my mentor, my mountain mentor. And he was heading off to climb Mount McKinley, now known as Denali, but in Alaska, 20,000-plus foot mountain. And as I was talking to him, this was only a few weeks after arriving, he said, well, I train for Mount McKinley on the top of Mount Washington. And I'm from Buffalo in New Jersey, and I thought, how absurd. Why would you train for a 20,000-foot mountain on the top of a 6,000-foot mountain? That didn't make any sense to me. So that sort of began my interest in figuring out why this short, stubby little mountain in the top of a mountain range near the top of the country is so significant. And the significance, as it turns out, has to do with the people whose own aspirations are reflected back at them. If you're an artist, if you're a car driver, if you're a motorcycle aficionado, if you like railroads, if you like weather, if you're a painter, there's something there for you. And so that's what I tried to accomplish in the book.
Well, and a couple sort of facts and figures since you mentioned the size of Mount Washington. I mean, you're right. It's big for, you know, this part of the country, but it's not that big.
No, not at all. 6,288 feet, some will tell you, and 2 inches. It sits at the top of the Presidential Range. I'm sure all of your listeners are aware of a lot of these numbers, but compared to a lot of the other mountains around the world that enjoy the same sort of legend and mythology, the Everests, the Fujis, the Kilimanjaros, Mount Washington is just short and stubby.
So how did Mount Washington get so, you know, super wicked amazing? Like such right. a draw for people right. when it is kind of, you know, a stubby rock pile.
Yeah, there's two things that are very specific to Mount Washington and to that area, to the Presidential Range. One, of course, is its extreme weather. It sits it sort of forms a wall between three weather fronts from the Atlantic, from the Canada, and from the Ohio Valley, and they're constantly butting heads up there. That's how the observers in, you know, kindergarten speak explained it to me, is that there's always these two or three weather fronts that are always coming together right at that range.
Okay, I was wondering about that. Yeah, because again, it's not that high, so why is the weather so bad? So that's why.
So that's one reason. So that's what draws a lot of people is, of course, it's how extreme it is. You know, for being in an alpine zone at 5,000 feet, that's unusual. It's because of the cold weather and the extreme weather and the wind and so forth. And the other thing is its accessibility. Right, Mount Washington is for 150 years now, over 160 years now. Mount Washington has been a mountain that, regardless of your age or ability or disability, regardless of how much coins you have in your pocket, you can go to the top of that mountain and experience that view along with anybody else, along with every other hiker, along with everybody motorcyclist, along with everybody who's driving the cog. So it's a magnet, right? I mean, it's a tourism magnet, of course, but it pulls skill and talent, right? If you're a painter, you can go to the top. You know, if you love motorcycles, you can go to the top. You know, if you love railroads, you can go to the top. So regardless of what you don't have to just be a climber or a hiker to share that view, to touch that summit sign. Much, I think, to the frustration sometimes of the outdoor community, but anyone can get up there. So those two things, the extreme weather and over a century of accessibility, make Mount Washington this incredible draw.
Well, and it's in this area of the country where there are a lot of major metro areas.
Yep.
People in general talk about the White Mountains and why they're so heavily used. And partly it's because the Whites and Mount Washington are within a relatively easy drive of a lot of people.
Yeah, and the numbers are going up. 250,000 people a year touch the summit sign at the top of Mount Washington.
Really?
There's,
wow.
20-something weddings at the observatory deck and many, many more engagements at the observatory deck every year. Both the Auto Road and the COG and, you know, the AMC register higher and higher numbers every year as people, more and more people go up. In fact, there was which, of course, we can talk about later, but which leads to more and more rescues and more work for the search and rescue teams. There was one just yesterday, in fact.
Well, and you and I talked about that on the show a couple months ago, the search and rescue and so forth in that area. And as you're talking about superlatives for Mount Washington, you know, so many visitors, the weather, the wind speeds, add danger to that list of superlatives, Dan. You write, for a relatively small mountain compared to the Rockies or the Himalayas or whatever, what makes this mountain a place where, you know, lots of people have died.
Yeah. There's a great book out by Julie Boardman called Death in the White Mountains. It just came out a couple months ago, which is sort of a statistical analysis of all the injuries and the fatalities. She lists 220 over the course of the mountain's lifetime, which is over the course of about a century, a little bit over a century. That's a lot. And I think part of it is it's accessibility is a double-edged sword, right? It's anyone can go up, but anyone can go up.
Including people who don't know what they're doing.
Including people who aren't
dressed
prepared.
In shorts and flip-flops, yeah.
And it amazes me how, you know, I mean, I wear a headlamp to take my garbage out at night. I can't believe it's so surprising to me that people climb this mountain or any mountain in the Whites without taking, you know, a flashlight. And that's what happened yesterday. So people are oftentimes simply because it's so short, and I'm putting short in air quotes, because it's so short, and it's only 4 miles to get to the top, right? That's not much of a hike. People go up there unprepared, often, and more.
How do those deaths affect the way people who live and work on this mountain feel about it? And I'm talking about, you know, the people who work at the hut, the AMC hut. I'm talking about the people who work at the observatory. I'm talking about people who work on the COG or people who work at the state park.
Yeah. The SAR teams, and I know many of the members of the SAR teams, I think you had...
Search and Rescue, right?
Search and Rescue, sorry. Yeah. Sandy Stott, who wrote an amazing book called Critical Hours, and folks like Samantha Brady, who they run the concessions. These folks are primarily volunteers. The vast majority of them are volunteers. And when you get that call, it's often, usually, you know, in the middle of the night. What I would say is that it's becoming almost a lifestyle for the search and rescue teams. I'm sure they would rather it not be. But you know, they have their packs ready, and they have their go packs ready, and you know, they get a call at 1 a.m. And they kiss their wives later, and they go off to help these folks. And to a person, the folks that I've talked to who are part of these teams, and by part of these teams, it's not just the search and rescue teams, but the crew members at the huts help, and the observers have been known to go down and help, and
so that,
you know,
whole
people
community
from the COG
there
and from the auto road are engaged
in
some of these search and rescues. And 201, you know, they grumble afterwards that so and so didn't bring his, you know, map and headlamp. But each and every one of them have created this sort of lifestyle for themselves where they sort of selflessly go up there and help these folks in the hope, I think, that someday those numbers will start to tick down instead of continue to go up.
Our guest today is author and journalist Dan Sesney. His latest book that we're talking about is called The White Mountain, Rediscovering the Hidden Culture of Mount Washington. Join us with your questions and comments. What are your stories about Mount Washington, your experiences, your thoughts about what makes this mountain in particular such an icon? You can join us 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. By the way, be sure to check out our website today. There's other articles by Dan Sesney. There's pictures of the Mount Washington Observatory cats. You don't want to miss that. Plus, we have an abridged history of development on Mount Washington, the auto road, the COG, and so forth. Join us again with your questions and stories at 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Dan, we got a couple questions from our listeners before we even got started today. David from Littleton says, while in high school, I worked one summer for the Forest Service's Youth Conservation Corps. One of our assignments was to dismantle a stone sauna hut located near the Lakes of the Clouds. One day when we were throwing stones over the edge of the Ammonoosuc Ravine, an A-10 warthog flew up the ravine from below us. We saw the stars on the top of the wings, and the pilot waved to us. Dave, what a story. Everybody's got a story.
Everybody has a story. Was it David? That's amazing, David. The plane story is amazing, but send me an email. I want to hear more about that stone sauna
well,
up at Lakes of the
Clouds. That's a little piece of history.
Right.
And the last time I was on Mount Washington, which was just last fall, you know, I hadn't been up there in a long time, and it was kind of cool. Like, you could see small planes below you.
Mm-hmm.
It was neat to be on eye level with the clouds.
Yeah.
So
when I was up at the observatory, I stayed for a week up at the observatory cooking for the observers. For a straight couple of days, we were we were above the clouds. It's called undercast, and the clouds were, you know, sort of circled just the tops of the mountains, and you could stand up at the top of Mount Washington, and as far as the eye could see from horizon to horizon, all you would see are just the tops of the bigger peaks poking out from the clouds, and it's a pretty amazing sight.
Well, Grace and Henniker asks two questions from Grace. What is your most memorable weather story from living at the summit?
Right.
And then Grace also says, surely it's not possible to fully anticipate it, what it's like to live atop the Northeast tallest summit. Please share your greatest surprises, unanticipated experiences, and aha moments. And actually, those two questions from Grace are connected because some
connected,
of those aha moments come from the weather.
Yeah, for sure. I'm very much a my career as a journalist very much has been what I call an experiential journalist. If I'm going to write about the observatory, I want to live at the observatory. If I'm going to write about the road race, I want to actually take part in the road race. So I was honored to live at the top of Mount Washington in early April. I was there in early April for a week.
So still winter.
It's still very much winter. The observatory has a volunteer program where you get free room and board, so to speak, and you get free food, and in return you have to cook for the observers. I'm a terrible cook, by the way, but they all survived, I'm happy to say, because I had a great co-volunteer by the name of John Donovan. I talk a lot about John in the book, who has some restaurant experience, thank goodness, because no ordering pizza up there once you're up there. And so I got to live up there for a week. And I had, because it wasn't the middle of winter, it wasn't January or February, because it was April, I had a variation of weather experiences while I was up there. The coldest it got while I was up there was minus 17. The warmest it got was in the 20s, which is a vast difference. And I got to my aha moment, I suppose, was I got to walk in 87 mile an hour sustained winds. 87 miles. So that's Hurricane 1's category. Hurricane 1 category winds. And I put on my parka and I got out and I walked out onto the observation deck. And I suppose it shouldn't surprise me, but my aha moment was, oh my God, how can the observers do this for a living? Because I could barely stand up. And you know, they go out and record these videos for school kids, you know, in wind speeds that are much higher than that. They have these great videos of these funny videos of, you know, trying to serve Cheerios and milk out on the observatory with the box flying up in the air and everything. And they love it, and I was terrified. I was 20 feet from the door of the observatory, and as I write in the book, all I kept thinking of, oh, this is how hikers die. You know, this is how you get lost in this wind. And
Why is the wind so powerful?
Yeah. Interestingly, when Adam Gill, one of the youngest observers up there, the fellow that I was with up there for a week and who I've become friends with, I asked him about sort of vertical wind speed versus horizontal wind speed. Because what I wanted to know is, everybody always talks about when the wind is so high you can get blown off the mountain, right? That's like a sort of a catchphrase. And I wanted to know if you could actually get blown off of the mountain. So I talked to him. I talked to Josh Judge, the meteorologist over at WMUR. And they both told me that tornadoes have vertical uplift.
They can literally pull you up.
But wind speeds at the top of the mountain are horizontal. So it can knock you down and it can roll you away, but it can't lift you up. But they did talk to me about why the wind is so powerful up there.
Okay, so being knocked down and rolling away doesn't sound that much more encouraging.
The end result would be the same.
Lots more to talk about after a short break. And Grace and David, thank you for those questions and stories. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. More on the White Mountain in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're talking with author Dan Sesney about his new book, The White Mountain. It's about his year with Mount Washington and the stories of the people who love it. Send us an email with your stories, experiences, questions about Mount Washington. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Also, be sure to check out our website today for more stories, articles by Dan, some pictures, and some more history. Again, it's nhpr.org/exchange. That's our website, and check it out today. So, Dan, couple big pieces of this book have to do with your time at the Weather Observatory. And as you told us before the break, you lived up there in April, so, you know, still wintertime.
Yep.
You talked about what it feels like to be outside and the wind and so forth. Talk about rime ice.
Yeah.
That's a big theme up there on Mount Washington.
Yeah.
What is rime
ice?
It's
pretty cool. It's when there's a lot, and now I'm not a meteorologist, so if you know one of the observers are listening and I get this wrong, please call in and correct me. But my understanding is that when the temperature, when there's enough humidity in the air, but there's heavy winds, there's strong winds, it actually will create sort of sideways snow, sideways ice, and it forms these. Back in the 1870s, one of the first groups that were up there to experience rime ice called it feathered sculptures, right? There are these feathered sculptures that form off of the side of buildings and off of their equipment, and it's all very delicate and light. As soon as you break it away, if the wind is blowing, it forms again. And in some cases, the rime ice can form, you know, 6, 7, 8, 10 inches, and it's unlike anything you're ever going to see. When I went out into the wind, the humidity was high enough that when we finally went back into the tower after about maybe 12 or 13 minutes, when we finally went back into the weather room, rime ice had started to form on my parka. My black parka had started to form these little feathers, these little slivers of ice on my shoulders and on my hands. It was really cool. Yeah.
How did it even happen that an observatory was built up there?
Yeah, back in the 1870s through the 1890s.
Oh, so a long time ago.
Yeah, the original, they weren't called it back then, but what eventually became the U.S. Signal Corps actually put an observatory into the Tip Top House, which is one of the original sort of hotels up there. And they did some, and I go into a little bit of detail about how that all happened, which is a very complicated process, because for the longest time, nobody thought you could survive up there in the wintertime. And then that sort of petered out, I think, 1892, early 1890s. And nothing happened as far as an observatory again until 1932. And there was four founders of the observatory. Everybody's heard of one of them, Joe Dodge, which is, you know, there's been books where he's
of
like
AMC
the Paul Bunyan
fame,
of New Hampshire.
That's a really good way to put it.
You know, I mean, his fame precedes him. You know, there's really no way to know whether he did wrestle that bear with his bare hands or not. But the other three guys, Alex McKenzie, Sal Pagliuca, and Bob Moynihan, the four of them, along with Tiki, the cat, their first mascot, who was up there. So there, I guess there's five founders. Formed the observatory in 1932, and in 1934 was when they recorded the world's. I've written it down because you have to actually say it properly. The world's fastest surfaced wind speed ever observed by man, at 231 miles an hour.
Yeah, you have to be careful because there's been some other places and people who have wanted to claim that title.
You have to say it that way because in the late 90s, in a cyclone off the coast of Australia, an unmanned buoy registered a higher wind speed. So, but that's cheating. That's not fair.
Well, and I read in your book that Mount Musilaki, another beloved mountain, in the Upper Valley, which is a region we're going to talk about actually tomorrow in the exchange,
helped get
the Mount Washington Observatory off the ground.
Because
at first people were like, I don't know if people can really live up there all year round. So Mount Musilaki helped out with that.
Yeah, there was a lawyer in Manchester, a guy by the name of Little, William Little, who was an amateur meteorologist. He loved weather. And he happened to own the land at the top, some land in Benton, New Hampshire, that included the top of Mount Musilaki. And he had a little summit house up at the top of Mount Musilaki. So when some of these first meteorologists and scientists were looking to go up there, including Joshua Huntington, Huntington Ravine is named after, were looking for a way to set up an observatory in those early days up at the top of Mount Washington. And everyone was like, well, we like the idea, but, you know, I don't want to be a sponsor of an expedition where everyone dies over winter. So the lawyer Little said, well, why don't you go up to Moose Lake? Do that first. Set it up there. That's still, you know, 5,700 feet or whatever it is. And if you survive that, then everyone will see that it can be done. And sure enough, they survived that and everyone saw that it could be done.
Let's go to our listeners again, Dan. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We're taking your questions and comments about Mount Washington, but not just the mountain itself, the many people who have loved this mountain, who have been inspired by it. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. And Ron is calling in, Dan, so we'll go to him on the line. Hi, Ron. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much, Laura.
Sure.
And Dan, a great program. When I was 7, I first went up Mount Washington to the summit with my dad. And tomorrow, that's tomorrow, I'm 77 now, and I'm making a journey up to the top. And I'm going to be playing my bagpipes and all. So there's something for the bucket list, and I'm sure you've got lots of things like that. But I just wanted you to know this is great, and I love the mountain, and I'm looking forward to it.
Wow, that's fantastic, Ron. What route are you taking?
The Tuckerman's Ravine.
You are? Are you actually going to play bagpipes up Tuckerman's Ravine?
No. I'm going to play them on the summit.
Oh, darn it.
But you're going to hike it, Ron. You're not going to walk up the auto road or drive up or take the cog.
Let me say that there's a debate going on even at this moment in the household between the...
Oh, oops. I think we lost Ron. Oh, I'm so sorry, Ron, that we lost you there.
Huh.
Maybe he was... you know, hiking while he was talking to us or something. I wanted to ask him, and I'm really sorry that we lost him, because you talk in the book about kilted hikers.
Yes.
So maybe Ron's a kilted hiker.
Yeah, there's an amazing collection of, you know, we might as well talk about hikers and Alton Weagleday. Ron would probably fit really well with Alton Weagleday. There's an amazing collection of hikers out there. The observatory does an annual fundraising event called Seek the Peak, where hikers from all over the world come together, and either they hike solo, they register, and either they hike solo or they hike in big groups to raise money and awareness for the observatory. And it's a crazy amazing day. Hundreds and hundreds of hikers up there. The cog is working, the auto road is going. So, and there's groups like the Kilted Hikers. It's John Donovan, in fact, who I mentioned earlier, is a member of that group. And there's 10 or 12 of them, and they all wear kilts, and they hike up the mountain. During Alton Weagleday, if Howie Wemyss from the Otter Road is listening, he can call and tell us whether or not there's been a bagpiper record set for hiking up the mountain, because maybe Ron would be interested in doing that.
So wait, Seek the Peak is a fundraiser for the observatory, and tons of people go, some dressed up in weird costumes?
Some dressed up in weird costumes. One of the people that I interview, her name is Curly Penzel, who's a 70-something sort of legendary hiker. She dressed up in all Hawaiian clothes, Hawaiian leis, and Hawaiian outfits. She hiked up. Some of the groups have specific themes that they'll dress up in, like the Kilted Hikers. You know, others just come up with their families, and a lot of people do solo hiking, but it's always fun to hike in a group. And, you know, you create a fundraising page beforehand, and people can contribute your fundraising page, and it all goes to the observatory. It's their major fundraiser.
So, and then on this similar theme of people doing, you know, slightly... odd ways of ascending the mountain. There's Alton Weagleday.
Yeah.
So you participated in this
as part
of your year with Mount Washington.
Yeah.
Who was Alton Weagle?
Oh boy, how much time do we have?
Every
year the Mount Washington Auto Road holds Alton Weagleday. And on Alton Weagleday, climbers, hikers from around, usually mostly around New Hampshire, get together. There was 20 in the group that I was in. Get together to try to set crazy records. Alton Weagle in the 1950s, Stark, New Hampshire, was a state licensed mountain guide. So he guided people up to the top of the mountain. was known as Mr. Mount Washington, Alton Mr. Mount Washington Weagle. And he currently holds the most records for climbing Mount Washington. And when I say records for climbing Mount Washington, I mean crazy things like he did it backwards. He did it barefoot. He did it on his hands and knees.
Barefoot. Ouch.
He did it blindfolded. He raced the cog to the top and he won. Things like that. His most famous, and the thing that got me, set me on his trail, is his most famous record, which was he pushed a wheelbarrow full of sugar up the outer road in one haul without putting it down. A wheelbarrow full of sugar. So, you know,
as strong arms.
Very strong. He was a very strong guy. You know, as a journalist, especially when I was writing this book, what I was constantly doing was asking a question and then answering the question. And my question was, why in heaven's name would anyone push a wheelbarrow full of sugar up to the top of the mountain? So I wanted to figure out who Alton Weagle does, and he's sort of been lost in the annals of history. So in order to do that, I wanted to participate myself. So I'm you know, at the Otter Road, they have a list of all of the records over the years that have been set. So you kind of go through those lists to make sure you're not doing one that's been done before. And, you know, I'm a writer and a big fan of poetry, and someone who reminds me a lot of Alton Weagle is Walt Whitman. They're sort of, in fact, the chapter is called The Gentleman Saunterer, because Walt liked to saunter through the streets of New York. So I actually dressed as Walt Whitman. I guess it's my first cosplay. I dressed as Walt Whitman, and I read Leaves of Grass all the way up the mountain. So you're now looking at the record holder of reading poetry while climbing Mount Washington.
Well, you'll have to sign my book afterwards.
Thank you. Yeah.
My goodness.
I don't think that's a record that's going to be beaten anytime in the near future.
So, you know, dressing up as Walt Whitman, pushing wheelbarrows of sugar up the mountain, wearing a kilt, playing the bagpipes. I mean, what is it about Mount Washington that inspires this kind of goofiness?
Well, as I mentioned before, it's the accessibility. I think anyone can, you know, the Otter Road allows for anyone to be goofy, you know, in relative safety, you know. But also, you know, the second thing is a lot of those organizations, like the COG, I mean, the COG has a steampunk festival, you know. So I think a lot of those organizations sort of actively market that sort of whimsy and connection to the past and to history. That could be so much fun. You know, that's why the observers, you know, record videos of trying to pour milk at the summit. That's why, you know, the cat mascots have their own column in the you know, the Weekly Observer report, because it's fun. You know, I mean, it's a fun place to be, and it's a fun place for anyone to be, even, you know, kids or anyone. So I my bet is that sort of comes naturally. I mean, even looking back into some of those first climbers, the 18th and 19th century climbers, some of them did goofy things too, like, you know, ride a penny farthing up the mountain, things like that. That's always happened.
What is that?
Oh, that's that big bike with the big front wheel and the tiny little back wheel.
Okay, yeah.
In the shape of a penny and a farthing. That's why it's called penny farthing.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to our listeners, Dan. And Anne joins us from Hollis. Hi, Anne. You're on the air. Welcome. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
If I lose you, it's because I'm driving to Vermont.
Okay.
Okay. So I have two quick brief stories. In the early 90s, my church offered a fundraiser at an auction. And, well, they have a fundraiser auction. And an elderly man offered a plane flight. So I purchased that. And the day that my sister and I went to meet him, he says, well, where do you want to go? We didn't care. He says, today is the perfect condition to fly over Mount Washington. Mm. So we buzzed Mount Washington in a very small plane.
Fun.
I have panoramic pictures.
Oh,
if your author there would be interested in seeing, I can dig them out someplace. I have them someplace. I have panoramic pictures of flying very close over the top of Mount Washington.
Oh, wow.
Amazing, amazing. I don't remember what month it is. I do know there's snow on top of it.
Well, and, you know, when you get a chance, either send them to us by email or put them on the Exchange's Facebook page, okay? So we'd love for all listeners to share their pictures and stories today.
Yeah. I'd
so
love
cool.
to see
it's
that.
It's one of my most memorable moments of the 28 years I've lived in New Hampshire.
Cool.
How long
okay.
ago was
and
this,
my other brief.
Oh, sorry.
Early 90s. And that's all I can remember.
What's your other
if
story,
If I find
Anne?
It, I probably have a date on the back of it. I'm sorry?
What's your other story? You said you had two stories.
The other quick story is about how the weather can change so quickly. For a commoner like me, trying to hike up the mountain, I don't remember the name of the trail, but we were hiking July 4th to go up to Lake of the Clouds Hut. black flies everywhere, over 80 degrees, extreme humidity, just hard, just really one of those struggling kind of hikes. We get up there, we're exhausted, so we can't bag the peak. We stay overnight with dozens of smelly people because there's no there are no showers there, snoring everywhere. You know, not good rest conditions, but we had to do this. We had to go out the next day and bag the peak. We have all the gear we think we need, but we wake up in the morning, it's under 50 degrees, over 50 mile an hour winds, sleeting. So we tried, but it was too icy. We didn't feel safe. We didn't get to bag the peak, but that's how the conditions changed in the 24 hours, July 4th and 5th.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. Anne, thank you so much for calling in. I'm sure you've heard other stories
that's the one she told. That's a very common story. I actually have a very similar story. She's probably talking about the Ammonoosuc Trail, which is the most direct route up to Lakes of the Clouds. And it's a pretty common route. People will go up the Ammonoosuc, they'll stay at the Lakes of the Clouds, and then they'll bag the peak and then come down the Jewel Trail, which is sort of a loop trail. That's probably what she was talking about. I remember a hike that I did with a friend of mine from out of town a few years ago where almost the same thing happened. We went up, we stayed at Lakes of the Clouds, and the next morning it was so foggy, there were maybe 10, 15 feet where we were literally following the cairns, those markers that lead us went. So we followed it from cairn to cairn, getting up near the summit. And, you know, there's a lot of buildings up at the summit, and we couldn't see anything. And I remember hunkering down behind a cairn. I knew that we were close to the summit, and a great wind sort of blew a lot of the fog, the fog away. And I realized that we were about 15 feet from one of the summit buildings. And I couldn't see it until the wind blew it away. Yeah, it was pretty amazing. And we were right there, and the wind blew it away. You could see the wall, and then the fog rolled in, and it disappeared again.
Well, it kind of helps you understand, too, why so many people have died on Mount Washington, right? There's a story from way back in the day about a woman, Lizzie, I can't remember her last name. She was really close to the top,
She went within view about 200 feet from the summit house. 19-year-old, she was the first woman to perish on Mount Washington. And she went up, she went up to the halfway house. The weather was pretty nasty. She went up, and it was so foggy and so overcast that her father was with her and a friend, and they hunkered down behind some rocks to try to get through the night. And the thought is that she got hypothermic and she passed away. And in the morning, as the sun was coming up, you know, and poor Lizzie had died, and, you know, they kind of scrambled out from their rocky outcropping and to see the summit building 200 feet away from them.
Well, that's the thing, and it keeps getting to this point that you keep making, Dan, which is, you know, it's so accessible to so many people, but the conditions, as you and our caller Anne describe, can be so extreme that it's kind of, you know, to use that overused phrase, the perfect storm for things to happen. Anne, thank you so much, and when you get a chance, submit your pictures, exchange@nhpr.org. Or you can post them on our Facebook page. And you can join us after a short break with more of your questions, comments, and, of course, your Mount Washington stories. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And, Dan, coming up after a break, I've got an email from someone who wants to know who owns Mount Washington.
Oh,
and that's a very pertinent question.
Yes.
So we'll address that in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. The Exchange has been going local all summer, exploring the unique regions of New Hampshire. And as part of our series, we'll be heading to Keene, the heart of the Monadnock region, to discuss the biggest issues facing that area and what residents love most about their home. The show will be live at Keene State College on August 16th at 9 a.m. So reserve your free tickets now at nhpr.org/events. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, our Going Local series continues, exploring the regions of New Hampshire. This Thursday, it's the Upper Valley. If you live in this region, what do you think people should know about it? What's great about living this area? What's not so great? Let us know. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. This hour, it's a new look at Mount Washington through a new book by Granite State writer Dan Sesney called The White Mountain. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter, NHPR Exchange, or give us a call right now, 1-800-892-6477. And Dan, here's an email from Tom and Rye. Would your guest care to comment on the maze of property rights and land ownership at the top of Mount Washington? Tom says there's often a misconception that all the land is owned by the state of New Hampshire, when in fact there are several private and nonprofit owners that dot the area at the top. A fascinating history of the land could be told. Tom, thank you so much. And I'm wondering about that too, right?
Yeah, like, me too.
The top of Mount Washington is a state park. But the Hutt, Lakes of the Clouds is AMC. The White Mountains themselves are federal. The COG is private.
As is
the observatory, I'm guessing, is nonprofit.
Nonprofit.
So
and they
he's
rent
right.
From the state. Yeah, it's a book in and of itself could be written about the sort of land history of the top of Mount Washington, because it's changed a lot. There was a time when Dartmouth College owned the top, the Mount Washington. There was a time when Dartmouth College owned the COG Railway, which a lot of people don't realize. So yeah, it's gone back and forth. I talked to there's a historian out of Conway, a guy by the name of Tom Cottrell, who knows a lot about this history. I don't get into it that much in the book, but it's amazing that so there's the Appalachian Trail Conservatory, there's the Appalachian Mountain Club, there's the National Forest, there's the State Park, there's Fish and Game, there's the COG, there's the Observatory, there's the Auto Road, and all of these entities sort of have to abide by each other and
that's
live
a lot
together
of entities.
At the top. Yeah, and you know, and occasionally there's disputes, but generally speaking, considering, and you know, some it's nonprofit, it's state, it's federal, it's private, so they get along pretty well, all things considered. So, yeah, Tom, thank you for that. Maybe that'll be the White Mountain. Part two will be a land history of the top of the mountain, because it is very interesting.
Tom, thanks for the email. Jerry in Dover sent us an email as well. He says, sometime in the early 70s while on active duty, I flew a Huey looking for a lost hiker. Whoa. He was eventually found dead, but I did not know anything about him until reading a Yankee magazine article about Mount Washington fatalities at my dentist's office years later. So, Jerry, thank you for that, because, you know, again, we keep talking about Mount Washington is so popular, and that's great, but it does mean things happen. Thanks, Jerry, for the email. And let's go back to our callers. Sebastian calls in from Greenfield. Hi, Sebastian. Go ahead.
Hi. I've been thinking and writing and researching about the great Abenaki chief, Passaconaway, the Bashaba, who ruled all the way from Piscataqua down to Connecticut River. And he claimed Mount Ogumanticos, I believe, is the indigenous name for Mount Washington. I may have it a bit wrong. But there's a wonderful Abenaki myth about how at the end of his life, he's carried off to the top of Mount Washington to live with the spirits up there. And there is also mention, and I would like to know if your author has ever come across this, of something called thunderballs. And people believed on the top of the mountain they could find these round balls, like a small bowling ball, and you split it open, and it has a sort of lightning-like effect inside, as though lightning was trapped inside the thunderballs.
Wow.
So,
Sebastian,
the great chiefs are on top of the mountain playing the thunderballs and before anybody.
Thank you so much for calling, because we should talk about how Native Americans viewed this mountain, approached this mountain. You write in the book, for example, Dan, that Europeans like to say, well, those Native Americans, they were afraid to go to the top of the mountain. But we don't really know
if that's true or not. And Sebastian, thank you for that. I actually wrote down thunderballs with a question mark, because
next book.
Because that's fascinating. I'm definitely going to look that up. So, yeah, the natives, Darby Field was the first European that we know of to summit the mountain way back in 1642, and he actually did it. He was a merchant out of the Portsmouth area, out of Dover, I believe. He also owned a ferry across the Great Bay, and he went twice in one summer, and back then, that was a considerable effort and a trip back then. It's unclear why he went. A lot, most Sir White Mountain historians will tell you, well, he, you know, there was the expectation of riches. You know, all the mica at the top of the mountain or the snow, you know, was thought to perhaps be silver or jewels or whatever. But he couldn't have done it without Native American guides. He actually had Native American guides who went up there with him. And he writes a little bit about how, you know, they stayed down below. They didn't go all the way up to the top with him because, as Sebastian said, they were afraid of angering, you know, the Great Spirit. Now, I asked Laura earlier to please don't make me help pronounce this, but I'm going to try anyway. I believe it's pronounced Agiochuk, Agiochuk, which is the original, what was called up there. And that's it's known as the place of the Great Spirit or the place of the concealed one. So the story, the legend is that they were afraid to go up there because that's the place of the Great Spirit. But they could have just been afraid to go up there because there's nasty weather and they didn't, you know, they didn't want to perish.
Or maybe they did go up there. Or, and maybe they didn't go up. White Europeans up there didn't really bother to ask.
Didn't bother to ask or to write it down. So, yeah.
Well, Sebastian, it's a great call. Thank you so much. And let's go to Susie in Berlin. Hi, Susie. Go ahead. You're in the air. Welcome.
Hi there. I was telling your screener that during the summer of 68, I worked up at the summit when they still had the old hotel. Yeah. It was a great experience. We'd have one day off where we could go down to the base or go to Gorham, have a pizza, do the laundry. There are times when we'd come back up at night and it being so foggy and so souped up there that we would need, you know, just one of us walking in front of the van to get up back to the summit. We used to party at the Tip Top House, which was a wreck at that time, and obviously no electricity or light. So just for the goof, we'd hang out there and do what we did. And it was a lot of fun. We were employed by the Cog Railway people at the time. So it was quite a lot of fun, not as many people, you know, surrounding the summit during the summer. Now it's just totally overrun, but, you know, it was just a lot of fun for a young kid.
Well, you know. Susie, I didn't realize that there was still a hotel at the top in as late as 1968. Is that what you said?
Yes, yes. I believe it might have been close to the last year. They might have had it running perhaps, you know, in 69. I know there was a very tragic accident where maybe one-third, I could be off on my measurements, but very soon after you left the summit, there was a train that jumped the tracks. I think a switchman, or there was some confusion of switching the tracks, and it slid off and luckily landed still, you know, on the summit, but where you're, there's a flat area where the, I think Air Force used to do some kind of testing or what have you, but several people were killed.
I remember reading about that, actually, yeah.
Yeah, my father was the sheriff at that time of Coos County,
wow. So
he was up there, you know, obviously assisting with all that, but
wow. Well, Susie, Lots of stories. Thank you so much for calling. And first of all, I mean, working at a hotel right at the top, you're a young person, 1968. But tell us a little bit more about that. I didn't realize that there was a hotel up there as late as that time period.
A fairly common story of if you were a teenager, early 20s in the 60s. I've heard this from a lot of folks who are now, what they probably be in their 60s now, I would guess. In fact, I interview one in the book, a guy by the name of Russ Staples, who also worked, maybe he knew Susie, worked at the for the COG. He worked at the Summit House in 1964.
That was the name of the hotel, the Summit House.
64, 65. And they employed a lot of young people back then, you know, early teenagers, or sort of the crew of Mount Washington. And Susie was right. They would actually be on for a week. They would have one day off. And in that one day off, you know, they would scramble back off of the summit to get down to the sort of the contra dances or the parties or whatever that were happening in, you know, Berlin or Gorham or Tamworth or wherever at the bottom of the mountain. And Russ tells these great stories. In fact, he was He was a senior in high school at the time. So that's how young that they were employing him. And he worked in they had a little sandwich shop at the summit, the COG did, for people coming up. And Russ made sandwiches for people who were coming up there. And they lived up there and they partied at the Tip Top House. He said the same thing. So that's a pretty common story.
So there's a proposal now, right, Dan, to build a hotel. We're not going to get into it because,
right.
you know, it's very controversial and you're not covering this in your book. But there is a proposal now to build another hotel.
There is. The COG
on the mountain.
Wants to... this stems all the way back to the COG's, land rights, the deed rights, all the way back to Sylvester Marsh in the 19th century.
Who's the
guy who built the COG? And the COG owns about 99 foot of right of way on both sides of the track, so 45 feet on both sides of the track. So they want to build about a mile, a little bit less than a mile, off of the summit on a little flat area down there. They want to build a hotel that would span the tracks, basically. So the COG would come in. They would bring, it wouldn't be a hut, it would be a more of a high-end hotel. And this, as you can imagine, has created a lot of controversy in the environmental and outdoors community.
Well, and on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, not only do we have information about your book and pictures and articles written by you, Dan, but we also have NHPR's Annie Ropeek's coverage of that issue. So we'll set it aside for now. And let's go back to our listeners. Mike joins us from Epping. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, my story starts with really in the 70s being a climber up in Maine, for the Wilderness Rescue Team.
Oh,
and Katahdin was my, of course, a lot of the rescues we had were up there as a backup to the park rangers there. But later, those are stories that are interesting. It makes me think of what all the things we're hearing here. Mm-hmm. But to New Hampshire and Mount Washington, my kids all learned at a young age, they've all climbed Mount Washington, and there were great stories. And we Glen Boulder Trail was our favorite trail that we took getting up there, and that was, you know, a challenge. And knowing how much it impacted them in their lives, two later, each one of them has talked about what they learned. You know, the challenges that climbing presented to them. You know, thinking they couldn't go any further, and finding that they had the will and the excitement they got when it reached the summit.
Wow.
All those things were great experiences for me and watching my kids grow. And then one time we had a friend with us with his young boy going up there, and he was having a heart attack.
Oh, no.
At least he thought he was. And he told me, he says, well, look, I went up. I knew it's a history in my family. My father had heart problems, and I thought, my God, why didn't you tell me this?
Yeah,
so,
before I took you up Mount Washington, that would be nice.
Yeah. He was trying to figure out whether he could make it. It was a challenge for him, trying to overcome this whole fear of having a heart attack, and then he panicked up there.
Wow.
And I ended up having to take him to Lake of the Clouds to get help. But my kids, who were young, still young, knowing that I felt that the number of times they'd been there, they could make it on the way up on their own.
Oh, so they had to finish on their own because you were helping your friend, Mike.
Yes. Yeah,
wow.
And they did.
Well,
Yeah.
Well, thank you for the story because it reflects, again, this broader theme in this book, Dan, that, you know, Mount Washington tests your reserves.
Yeah.
It tests your mettle. And, you know, when you come out the other side, and most people do, even though we've talked about the dangers, you kind of feel like, wow, I did that.
Pushing yourself and the sense of accomplishment afterwards is a big theme in the book and a big... part of Mount Washington's history. And, you know, and we talked a lot about the sort of physical pushing yourself, but, you know, in the book I talk a lot about other ways to push yourself too, as, you know, being a better painter, being a better runner. The number of people who I've spoken to who have gone up the mountain after beating cancer, for example, or in the memory of someone who has passed away of cancer. There's so much of that. Over and over again, you hear these same stories of that mountain becoming a place to get yourself back on your feet, to push yourself just a little bit further, to accomplish something.
To mark something.
To
you
mark
mentioned
something.
All the marriages that are on Mount Washington,
right.
Or wedding proposals. It's
yep.
sort of
records,
a place
all that,
that
stuff.
People seek to... To represent meaning in their lives.
Yeah, to represent meaning in their lives. And a lot of the characters that I talk to, Alton, you know, George, the Roadrunner, Barbara Hall, one of the first Hutt girls, all of them approach the mountain in the same way. This is a place, a landscape, that marks their lives in some way.
Well, speaking of sort of pushing yourself, Sarah in Whitefield emails. She says, my family includes several ardent and accomplished hikers and mountaineers. The peak bagging term, Sarah says, always strikes me as disrespectful of the mountains and weather. It is by grace and good fortune, not entirely our skill and merit, that we have the gift of being in the mountains and returning safely, much less summiting. So, Sarah, thank you for those words. Right. She also says, what is the proper pronunciation of Musalaki? That's what I called it. Yep. Sarah says, in our circles here, we do not pronounce the hard E on the end. Sarah, you're right. There's a couple different ways to pronounce it. And we're doing our Going Local series tomorrow on The Exchange. Is on the Dartmouth-Sunapee region.
Awesome.
So I'll ask those people your questions, Sarah, and I really appreciate the email. So, Dan, so many great stories in this book.
We
so many people.
We could,
who've been drawn to this mountain. But I just wanted to close out by asking you what stories are not told in this book that you could have told.
Oh, my goodness. There is an amazing organization out of Laconia called Alternative Sports, and they every year they do a sunset hike with handicapped athletes, ALS, folks who can't go up on their own. And their own means, and they have these mule teams. Sometimes each athlete has 12, 15, 20 people on their team. They close the auto road. They go up at 3 in the morning, 2 in the morning. They spend all day bringing these folks up to the top of the mountain so that they could watch a sunrise from the top of Mount Washington. That is an amazing story. I wanted to be part of that last year, but the weather was lousy. So if I had to add a chapter to the book, it would be on them.
Well, the name of the book, again, as you said, is The White Mountain,
The
White Mountain.
Right.
The White Mountain, meaning Mount Washington.
Yes.
Dan, it's been really fun talking to you. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been so great to be here. Thank you.
That's author Dan Sesney. He's written several books, including, again, the latest we talked about, The White Mountain, Rediscovering the Hidden Culture of Mount Washington. Be sure to check out our website today. Lots more information, photos, links there. It's nhpr.org/exchange. And this is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.